Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and our guest today is Susan Croft, who is a writer, curator and historian of alternative theatre and especially women's theatre in Britain. She's the author of She Also Wrote Plays and also the co-founder with Jessica Higgs of the Unfinished Histories Project. And the reason for our meeting is that she has just curated a new exhibition called Restaging Revolutions, which is currently at the Oval House in South London. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Susan.
Thank you.
Could you start off by talking a bit about Unfinished Histories? You've already talked to Theatre Voice about the origins of the project, so could you give us a bit of an update about progress in the past 3 or so years?
Well, I think the key thing is that we decided last year, probably decided prior to that, but went for it last year to try and get some proper funding from Heritage Lottery. And we've also, we changed our name, so we officially became Unfinished Histories Limited. We were previously a sort of sub-project of the company Jess had set up called In Tandem. And then we became a charity. So there's been a lot of organisational changes. So we've now got trustees, though we're still looking for more, so if anyone's interested, they should contact us. If they, at the end of this, they think this is an organisation I'd like to support, because we've got to then take all of that forward. But the big thing has been writing the HLF application, getting the funding, and as a result of that, setting up an office in Bethnal Green, all of which is great, but then, you know, there's an impetus with that which we've got to then sustain. So there's this project has come out of it as a most immediate fruits, and this is going on to the Kentish Town Community Centre in the new year, and then to London Borough of Camden Archives and Local History Centre. But beyond that, there is so much more to do. And, you know, every time you do something around the alternative theatre movement, I mean, here we're looking at roughly 50 companies we've focused in on in detail. Obviously, loads of other people come forward and say, but what about my company? And you've not even got me on the list. And you know, there's another history there, which we're already aware of, but that's developing all the time, and the demand is growing all the time, and the need is there. So, yeah.
With Unfinished Histories, are you funded for a certain period of time or to do actual projects?
It's essentially been project funding. I mean, the whole thing's been done on, you know, complete shoestring and through massive self-exploitation, largely. Yeah. I mean, even with the Heritage Lottery, which is the first time we've, for a long time actually, that we've had money to pay ourselves, but, you know, you end up getting paid on paper for a day and a half a week and doing sort of 6 or 7 days a week.
Of course.
So it's one of those, a bit like the alternative theatre movement itself, strangely enough.
Exactly. Let's talk about Restaging Revolutions. As I've said, it's currently at the Oval House, and as you've said, it's moving north of the river early next year. But could you tell us a bit about this exhibition? When did you have the idea, and what was the scope of it?
Well, I mean, it's not just an exhibition. I think that's the important thing to sort of assert first off. What we wanted to do and have wanted to do for a long time is to create web pages, histories of some of the companies we had listed in the companies list. So on the Oval Histories website, which we developed, I don't know, probably about 5 years ago, we started off by putting in the information about the people we'd interviewed and creating biographies for them and topics lists, etc. And then just mentioning the specific companies they'd worked with. But then we got a bit ambitious, and despite having, again, minimal funding for it, we made long lists of all the companies that we could find who were part of the alternative theatre movement, and lists of productions and venues and organisations and kind of key events, etc. But the companies was always key within that, and we were always ambitious that we'd like it that you could go to that list and, you know, gradually we would get a build up to a situation where you could click on a name and have a page pop up giving what information was known about that company. So we wanted to do that. When we went to speak to Heritage Lottery, they said they wouldn't fund a project which was just about creating web pages. They'd want something more public, and we said, okay, well, we'd be keen to do an exhibition as well.
Oh, that's curious, because yes. Actually, yeah. Web pages are probably the most accessible form of information display, you know, because anybody in America, for example, or in China can access the website.
Absolutely. So yes, I mean, they're very public like that, but on another level, they, you know, they're there. You have to kind of go and find them or stumble across a link or something. So they don't kind of necessarily push themselves into your attention unless you kind of happen to be looking for the right thing and then you stumble across it. And we constantly get people saying, wow, I just found your amazing site, etc. And we think it's a pretty amazing site. But it's also very nice to be doing something which is more in the public eye, in terms of having a physical location, especially at a place like Oval House, we'll obviously come on to talk about. And also somewhere we can celebrate, I mean, some of the visual richness of the movement. I mean, obviously the shows themselves have disappeared, but there are photographs and there are some incredible posters. And I think from a graphic design point of view alone, I think, you know, all sorts of graphic design students ought to be trooping in looking at what happened and how this work was put together and what a poster looked like and how it was screen printed or kind of done in letter set and so on. So that's just another wonderful aspect of the movement, which you can show on a website to a degree, but not in quite the same glory.
It's also part of that British cultural thing about do it yourself.
Absolutely.
I mean, nobody sort of waited around for other people to do their leaflets. They just did them themselves.
Absolutely.
This exhibition and aspects of this project, which, as you've pointed out, also includes talks and so on and readings, focuses on Lambeth and Camden, two London boroughs. Could you explain why you did that?
Well, again, it sounds like it's all dictated by the funding masters, but it was, you know, our response to their concerns. They said, OK, well, you need to sort of narrow it down. And obviously we weren't going to be able to do pages for everyone. And then immediately became a question, is it going to be a project which focuses on, say, theatre and education within the movement or gay and lesbian companies or black and Asian companies? And because it's the first large-scale public exhibition that we've done a couple of smaller ones previously, we thought, no, we don't want something which is just for one community, but one which shows the huge diversity of the project, even if it's just picking a few from each of those various categories. We had to narrow it down in a different way. So we thought, okay, well, why don't we look at a couple of London boroughs where there's particular richness in terms of the work which was produced. And then we discovered, while we were already thinking, well, Oval would be a really good place to look at, that it was going to be Oval's 50th anniversary as a performing arts venue. So that was, at that point, became wonderful serendipity. We thought, okay, we've got to do this. It kind of put an extra pressure on the project because then we had to deliver it within 2013, which fortunately we've managed just about. excuse me. But we also wanted to look at Camden because Camden just had so many venues. I mean, there's, you know, the New End and the Open Space and the Roundhouse and the Hampstead Theatre, which was originally an alternative theatre venue, though it's not terribly alternative now, you know, and a whole wealth of others. And when we actually looked at Kathy Itzin's alternative theatre directory, and because we've put together a map, a digital map, where, you know, you can kind of locate the various postcodes of where key venues were or key companies were based. I think particularly in the 1979 volume, but also quite a lot of the other ones, about 50% of the companies listed have a Camden address. And I think there are lots of reasons for that, particularly in 79 and 80 and so on, which I can talk about. But
Why was Camden so important?
I mean, I think one of the key issues is something which we kind of explored a bit in an event we did earlier this year, because we found we had access to some larger spaces within the building that we're renting an office at Bethnal Green at St Margaret's House Settlement. We thought, okay, well, we better do some events. So we started having regular, what we called monthly salons. And one of the salons was about exploring something which I'm sure there's a key relationship here. And the more I've done on it, the more I've felt that that relationship is absolutely vital to what happened with the alternative theatre movement. Anyway, the event was called Ajit Squat, and it was looking at the relationship between squatting and the alternative theatre movement, partly looking at some plays which dealt with squatting, both a street theatre piece that Rough Theatre did and also a documentary play that James Saunders did about squatting in Twickenham. But it was also looking at, you know, how squatting and cheap housing and kind of licensed co-ops that kind of grew out of that supported the alternative theatre movement. And it's just been reinforced by so many interviews and so many accounts from companies, how they were able to make the work because they were able to live cheaply. And Camden, you know, there was the Thomas Square squats, the Prince of Wales squats, which are supposed to be one of the biggest squats in Europe, certainly the biggest squat in Britain, where there were kind of huge tracts of housing which was under planning blight, or that Camden Council couldn't afford to do up, or, I mean, which was actually rescued. I mean, it's now terribly bijou, lovely residences, and a few bit of it's still kind of owned by the council, but, you know, the people who bought those houses should be eternally grateful to the squatting movement who preserved them. But also the alternative theatre movement is completely indebted to the squatting movement, and the two things overlapped in that people rehearsed in those buildings. There were kind of old, also, you know, just the fact that there was a lot of cheap, empty accommodation, generally in terms of schools. I mean, theatre centre was based in a school for a long time. And in church halls and so on, all the sort of buildings that nowadays, if they were empty, they've been turned into luxury flats and so on, and now there's a kind of problem with lack of school places, but so they have to build new ones instead. But I mean, you know, that the fact that there was a lot of empty space around, Stirabout, which is the first company that went into prisons, they used to rehearse in a house which sounds like it was in Bishop's Avenue, the kind of most exclusive address in London, you know. But all of that kind of empty space, empty buildings and so on, lent itself to the squatting movement. And Camden, I think that's a key reason, as I say, why things started there. Another key reason for Camden's kind of centrality to the movement, I think, is the work of Interaction, which set up opposite the Roundhouse in 1968, Ed Berman's company, or rather umbrella group of companies, and they then built the first bespoke community arts centre, the Talacre Centre, which was designed by Cedric Price in Kentish Town, and that became the base for a lot of other companies, both Interaction's own companies, like, I mean, a whole range of them. There was Dog's Troop and the Fun Art Bus, which was a kind of project which Dog's Troop contributed to, and Tok, or the other company that Naftali Yavin set up. Unfortunately, he died very early on in 1972, but was a physical theatre company, and the Old Age Theatre Society, and the British and American Theatre Association. Anyway, I can't quite remember the name of that one, but I can put it on the website. Anyway, there were a whole range of projects that came out of Interaction, and not just theatre projects. There was the City Farm, which was set up in Kentish Town, the first community media van, etc., etc., etc. Lots of people volunteered for those projects, became part of their kind of their housing association. And then a lot of people were inspired by that to take that work elsewhere and set up their own projects. So, yeah, lots of reasons why Camden. And one main reason why Lambeth, namely Oval House, because everybody performed here. And although there are other venues as well, it shouldn't be forgotten, like, you know, St Matthew's Meeting Place in Brixton and various others.
I'm talking about people performing. A lot of your exhibition is posters, leaflets, photographs, occasional scripts even. Can you talk about some of the other companies that sort of spring to mind?
Oh, well, there's who are in the exhibition.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we've got a whole range. I mean, we've got Action Space. There's an original design by Ken Turner. Action Space was set up in roughly 68, again, in Camden. in Harmood Street, and I haven't established whether that was a squat, though I think it's very likely that it was at the time, and then moved to take over the building which was Action Space Drill Hall, and then became the Drill Hall, now sadly lost as a public venue. It's now part of RADA. But they did enormously wonderful and innovative kind of large-scale structures and inflatable bouncy cushions, and took them out to community festivals. And I mean, their work was had a lot of very serious theory behind it as well, from a kind of architectural point of view. They were involved in Joan Littlewood's project to create a fun palace, which is going to get further explored next year, and I'm hoping we're going to be part of that. So we've kind of included some material about them in the exhibition, and they then moved to Barnsley, Action Space Mobile, though there's still an element in London. We've featured Beryl and the Perils, which was a feminist theatre company, as the name might well imply, who used the image of Beryl the Peril from the comic as a starting point for a very kind of rough and ready punkish comic strip inspired kind of work, but addressing feminist issues. So they've got shows like Is Dennis Really the Menace? And Nuts, and so on, which has lots of resonances. Broadside Mobile Workers Theatre, excuse me, who had been very much neglected. There's a little bit of a section on them in the book Stages in the Revolution. And I should say that Stages in the Revolution, which was a book by Kathy Itzin, who I mentioned previously, who another of the kind of undersung heroines of this era. She dealt with political theatre in Britain since 1968. The book came out in 1980. And there were two or three books that came out of that period which began to document what was going on, but there's actually been very, very little since. So she kind of gave an account of various companies who were part of that political theatre movement, and organisations like TACT, the Association of Community Theatre, and some of the politics of the time, other companies like Northwest Spanner, etc. But since then, I mean, I'm not aware of anything that actually had looked at what Broadside did. And the work that they were taking out to kind of trade unions and perform at factory gates and in a whole range of different contexts, the play called The Big Lump, which was about building sites and the lack of health and safety regulation and deaths on building sites and so on, and hiring practices. And a whole range of other plays, the Working Women's Charter Show. So we wanted to kind of capture those stories, and so we've done extensive interviews with founders, and then the volunteers have put together web pages, but we've got posters in the exhibition. So there's the whole range of different companies like that.
We mentioned before about the Oval House, and also you pay tribute in the programme that accompanies the exhibition, which is fantastically illustrated and beautifully clear as a account of some aspects of alternative theatre, to Kate Crutchley. Could you talk a bit about her? Because she had a kind of pivotal role, didn't she?
Yeah, she died this year in August, and we, you know, would have wanted to make her central to the exhibition anyway, because she was such a vital influence. I mean, my kind of period with the alternative theatre movement, personally, came quite late on, in that I started coming to Oval House in the late 80s. But it was such an exciting venue, and this is when Kate was theatre programmer. She was theatre programmer from 81 to 91. And there was not only just such an amazing array of companies performing here who she had brought in or commissioned, so experimental work, women's work, gay and lesbian work, black work, Asian work in particular, but there was a sense of, I suppose, yeah, of a movement, of belonging to something. It was a place I felt at home, and I felt, you know, invited in, and I was just kind of getting going in my very early career setting up an organisation called New Playwrights Trust that later became WriterNet. And, you know, so I was quite sort of shy about what I was doing and hoping to do. And I remember feeling incredibly welcomed by Kate. And I think that was the way a lot of people felt. And so, and then she'd sort of talk to them if they were artists, and she'd say, well, what kind of work are you interested in making? And, you know, when we were doing the interviews, I mean, we put together a little edited piece called Celebrating Kate Crutchley. We'd actually did a few years ago, and we've shown it again, and we'll show it again this year, which was put together from people's interviews, where without prompting, people would say things like, oh, but Kate Crutchley is so vitally important to this movement. Oh, and Kate Crutchley gave me £200 to commission my first show, and then that became, you know, the first show of That's Not It, Natasha Morgan's show, or Micheline Wandor talking about, you know, Kate directing plays that she scripted for, like Care and Control for Gay Sweatshop, which was a play about the struggles of lesbian mothers to retain custody. Safely historical, we trust nowadays, obviously. But at that time, you know, it was a huge issue. So she had a kind of earlier career with Gay Sweatshop and with doing work for Women's Theatre Group. She did a number of documentary plays, and she directed for her own company, Character Ladies. But that period, those 10 years at Oval House, were a really important 10 years. But, you know, the years before that in the 70s were also vitally important, and so was the work under Peter Oliver. I mean, it's such a hugely important venue that constantly reinvents itself and, you know, seems to have its finger on the bottom of the latest thing. So everybody comes through Oval House at some point in their career.
And it's fascinating about Kate Crutchley because, of course, that was the Thatcherite era where the general political climate was against a lot of these movements and so on. What are the sort of challenges of exhibiting theatre materials? Have you found it difficult to collect documentation on those alternative theatre companies?
Yeah, it's very patchy. I mean, some people... I mean, I'm a great hoarder myself, so I've got my own kind of collection, which has now kind of migrated really into the Unfinished Histories collection. And then there are some hoarders we've located. Neil Hornick, founder of The Phantom Captain, has brilliant documentation of the company. Every little kind of performance intervention they did in the streets where, you know, it was one of those companies where often you wouldn't... They worked on the basis that you didn't necessarily know that performance was taking place. That I'd kind of do a freshers event at a student union and so on, that turned out halfway through to be completely bogus and fictional, but up till that point people wouldn't have quite realised that. Anyway, he's got brilliant documentation and kept everything, but other people kept nothing, and then you kind of have to hunt around and try and find who might have something.
Are there somewhere. Any big gaps that really stick out that almost you'd be sort of happy to appeal?
Well, we'd love to find more material on black theatre companies. Yeah. We've got quite a lot on Black Theatre Co-op. We've been trying to track down material on Umoja, and fortunately the person we've been talking to about that, who does have some stuff, has been ill, so we weren't able to put that into the exhibition in the end. We maybe will try and put it in when we move to Kentish Town and Camden if we're successful with that. I mean, I would kind of make a general appeal. We'd love to get more material in. But we've had, I mean, what's been brilliant about the project is that because we've had this team of volunteers who we recruited back in January, who've been working all year, going out to the companies and interviewing the originators and creating the web pages. And some of them have been just incredibly tenacious in going and finding stuff and not giving up. So one volunteer in particular, Sarah, she we came up with a shortlist, because the idea was that each volunteer would try to do five web pages, five companies, and in the process of going to them, as I say, would find material for the exhibition. She was down to try and contact somebody from Brixton Fairies, who we obviously wanted to feature because of the Oval House connection and the Brixton connection. And we're getting no responses to the various exploratory letters and emails we sent out, but she stuck with it, and in the end she found, you know, the person who was the historian of Brixton Ferries, had all this material. Unfortunately, most of it is now in the LSE. Well, from our point of view, it's in the LSE, and it was then more complicated to borrow it back. So we haven't got a lot of material in the exhibition on them, but there's a wonderful web page that she's put together. And Crystal Theatre also is another one I was going to say. So we'd love to have more stuff from people on any of these companies.
But even just having located it is a plus, isn't
it? Absolutely, because we can then link, obviously, to the web pages that there are for them and the library catalogue from our page.
And which discoveries are you proudest of? I know it's a difficult question, because obviously you're very proud of many, many things in this huge project. But do any things actually stand out that you think, well, that's really wonderful?
Well, I mean, we've got some, in terms of objects in the exhibition, I mean, we've got a poster for Vagina Rex and the Gas Oven from 1969 at the Arts Lab Drury Lane. In fact, we actually bought that because it was such a rare find.
Absolutely.
I mean, most of the material that's from the Arts Lab seems to have been dispersed, or Jim Haynes has it hidden away, but not accessible somewhere in Paris. So we were just, and it's in such good condition, we just thought, great, we've got to have that in there, because that was the first Women's Liberation Movement play, and the Arts Lab was another of those venues, albeit it was only around for 2 years, that, you know, where everybody, Pip Simmons' group performed, the People's Show performed, Stephen Burkhoff's London Theatre Group performed, loads of work was started there. So that's a lovely object. But I mean, but finding stories over the course of the project, I shouldn't say just for this one, but I mean, Warehouse La Mama, when we discovered the whereabouts of Beth Porter, that was really a really important moment. She, I put on one of the panels that there were three Americans who kind of are seen as being key figures in the alternative theatre movement in Britain, namely Charles Maravitz, Jim Haynes and Ed Berman. However, there are, you know, another three at least you can mention, though there are more beyond that, both men and women, but three women, American women, who were also absolutely vital to the movement, who've tended to be more forgotten about in that context anyway, which is Beth Porter, who started Warehouse La Mama, Nancy Meckler with Freehold, another hugely underdocumented company, though obviously her work with Shared Experience has had more recognition, and Nancy Duguid, unfortunately, who died a few years ago, who was with Gay Sweatshop and did a lot of work with women's companies and lesbian companies and gay companies over the course of her career. So, you know, we wanted to kind of celebrate them. So we've got a bit of material on Warehouse La Mama. We've got a page on Warehouse La Mama. It was also, we found out, I can't remember quite how it happened, but we sometimes were, you know, odd serendipities, or people found us or whatever, or said, wait a minute, you know, you should know about us as well. So Stirabout, Corinna Seeds, who now lives in Greece, she got in contact with us a bit mistrustfully, I think, at the beginning. What is this project? But subsequently has, you know, written us an absolutely glowing letter about how important this was to her, that the project was documented and celebrated and this context has been created. Because as a company which performed in prisons, obviously it didn't get reviewed, didn't get covered, it got the odd article, you know, written about it in Plays and Players perhaps, but the material has been, well, she's got what material there is generally. There weren't posters in the same way. We've got a wonderful, in the exhibition, we've got a violin made of matchsticks, which there's a lovely story about. It was made by prisoners. I'm not sure, I can't remember which prison it was now. And they had a sort of little, not exactly business, but they were making these matchstick violins for various people. And Stirabout said, oh, we'd love to have one. So they were kind of in the list of orders. And then the prison governors clamped down on these because they thought, oh, maybe these are being used to smuggle contraband in or out of the prison. So the unfinished violin for Stirabout ended up being smuggled out of the prison in a blackout during the show when they did a quick switcheroo and passed it over to put in the prop box or whatever. And then, that made its way out, and we've got it in the exhibition. So at the moment, we're kind of completing the captions a bit belatedly, but that will then tell that story.
On that wonderful note, thank you very much, Susan, and good luck with the future.
Thank you.